God knows the end from the very beginning. Knowing that truth should be very comforting to all of us, because he tells us what the end is, and the end is good. For those of his people, there is nothing bad about the end. You've heard the old story. I've read the back of the book. We win, right? So God knows the end from the beginning, and we know the end works out great for God's people. That should be terribly comforting for us. But sometimes the place that we find ourselves in the meantime doesn't always look anything like where we hope to end up, right? And sometimes we can think, well, I know God promises this, and this is God's blessing, but why am I in this situation now? And how is God ever going to take this situation and turn it into something good that works to his end? And so we go through these ups and these downs in life, and we have to learn how to deal with those things. Isaiah chapter 46, though, gives us this comfort. And Isaiah was writing to those who God had punished and was punishing for their sins. But he comforted them in saying that, you know, their punishment was not going to be forever. Isaiah chapter 46, and in verse 10, well, verse 8, he says, "Remember this and show yourselves, O men. Recall to mind, O you transgressors. Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is no other." All right, so if God is God and there is no other, God's purpose will stand, because who's going to conflict with God's purpose? There is no other. There's nobody who can stop his purpose from being accomplished. "I am God, there is no other. I am God, and there is none like me," God says, declaring the end from the beginning. If God says this is the way it's going to be, I don't care what happens along the way, there's nothing that's going to prevent what I said the end is going to be. Declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times, things that are not yet done, saying, "My counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure." Now, if that isn't comforting to us, knowing that we're God's people, and that he's the one who is our rock, our salvation, he's the one that we can count on, he is God, and he's got our back, I don't know what more comforting thing there can be for God's people, right? "I am God," he says. "I declare the end from the beginning." So it's a matter of trust. But along the way, getting to that end point, we have the promise of his guidance. We have the promise of his protection. We have the promise of his presence with us on that journey along the way. But a lot of the times, it's to us feels like that team building exercise that we do sometimes at camp. You know, when we get the dorms together and we're trying to get them all to know each other and to start to trust each other, sometimes we'll have novelty Olympics and we'll set them into teams and we'll blindfold everybody in a line except for the last person and then send them over an obstacle course. And the last person is the only one who can talk. Now, the last person, they're all, you know, hands on shoulders of the person in front of them, but everybody in this line is blindfolded except for the person who's at the very end of the line. And that person has to guide the team through an obstacle course, over and around things, to the end. So the last person can see where they're going. And by that person's instructions, okay, two shuffle steps forward, now one step to the right, now has to lead them along the way to get to the end. Well, you can imagine what it feels like to be the first person there, the one with the blindfold on, that all you've got to go with is the directions from the person at the end of the line. And sometimes it's pretty comical to watch this group, you know, snaking their way, tripping their way along to get to the end place. And you can feel as you're going along that we're never going to get there. This is not working very well. And we can feel sometimes, spiritually speaking, as we're going through this course in life that, okay, God said we're going to get to this end, but right now, it sure doesn't feel like we're ever going to make it, right? You're like this blindfolded person on this team-building trust exercise. Now, partly, of course, when you're talking about that team-building exercise, the success of it is dependent on the ability of the one who's in the back to communicate clearly, doesn't it? And that's part of the exercise, the need to learn how to communicate instructions, how to be clear. But the other part of the exercise is for everybody else in the line to learn how to listen and to be able to follow. And, you know, sometimes we hear the words, but it doesn't translate well. And sometimes we hear the words and we don't want to do it because, you know, we might feel like we're going up a ramp and we don't know where the end of that ramp is and when, you know, the bottom's going to drop off or something. And we don't want to go any farther. And the person says, take another step, and you don't want to take the step. And so you can fight the instruction sometimes, and it becomes an exercise in trust. And then there's the problem of being human beings. We hear one thing and do something differently because it interprets differently. How many times were we climbing? Like this last week, we were out on the rocks, and I was belaying somebody who was up there on the rock, and they were at a point where they didn't know what to do. And so I said, well, look to your left. And they looked to their right. And I said, no, your other left. Oh, there was a place. Okay, and then they could go on. But, you know, we hear it, but it doesn't translate well in our own heads. So there's the problem sometimes in not communicating clearly, but there's also the problem in not hearing properly. And the more difficulty we have in hearing properly and then following the instructions, obviously, the more difficult the journey is going to be along the way. I think there's a spiritual lesson there for us. God has his sight, and God gives us instructions. Sometimes we don't hear it well, and sometimes we don't like what we hear and we don't want to follow. And sometimes we don't trust the instructions, and we end up in places that aren't comfortable and that don't look like they're going to get us to the end successfully. So there's an exercise in trust that we have to have as we follow God. But, you know, I think it's a good lesson. While we were at Joshua Tree, the group read through the book of Genesis. And then we discussed it after we read through. We talked about it a little bit. And something struck me as we were reading through the book of Genesis this time, and that was the story of the life of Joseph. What struck me about it, you know, here was a man, a youth, just a teenager when his brothers sold him into slavery, and he went down into Egypt, far from his family. And we'll go through a little bit of the story of Joseph's life. But he had his share of trials. He had his share of setbacks, you might say. But the question to ask for us as we look at the life of Joseph is this. Are the things that we see as trials or setbacks, is that what they really are? Or are they stepping stones? You know, when you're in that conga line, blindfolded, and then the one who has the sight says, okay, now make a U-turn, that doesn't necessarily sound like progress. But there are U-turns that we take, and sometimes that's the only way to make it. Setbacks, or apparent setbacks, are often only stepping stones, even though they might not feel like it along the way. Let's turn back a couple of pages in Isaiah to Isaiah chapter 44. Isaiah chapter 44 and verse 1. It says, yet hear now, O Jacob my servant, and Israel whom I have chosen. Thus says the Lord who made you and formed you from the womb, who will help you. Fear not, O Jacob, my servant, and you, Jeshurun, whom I have chosen, for I will pour water on him who is thirsty and floods on the dry ground. I will pour my spirit on your descendants and my blessing on your offspring. Okay, God was providing good promises of good things. They will spring up among the grass like willows by the watercourses, and one will say, I am the Lord's, and another will call himself by the name of Jacob, and another will write with his hand, the Lord's, and name himself by the name of Israel. God offers hope of the outcome, the conclusion. We can have confidence in the conclusion, the end of the matter. realize that Israel was not always feeling right now at this point when Isaiah was writing that things were going that well. But he's offering this promise. Verse 6, thus says the Lord, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, I am the first and I am the last. Besides me, there is no God. And who can proclaim as I do? Let him declare it and set it in order for me. No, God's the one who sets things in order. And this is a challenge. He's saying, who's going to change what I declare to be the right order of things? Nobody can do that because God is God. He said, since I appointed the ancient people and the things that are coming and shall come, let them show these to them. He said, do not fear, nor be afraid. Why did he have to say that? If God's going to make them so prosperous and all these things good, why does he say, don't be afraid? Because they've got this obstacle course to walk before they get there, don't they? Do not be afraid. Have I not told you from that time and declared it? You are my witnesses. Is there a God besides me? Indeed, there is no other rock. I know not one. We can have confidence in God that he will see us through to success at the end. That's tremendously hopeful, tremendously inspiring. Romans chapter 4. Romans chapter 4 and verse 17. Oops. Romans chapter 4. Verse 17, as it is written, I have made you a father of many nations. He's writing this of Abraham, who was told by God at the time, as an aged man, he and his wife, having no children, he was told that he was going to be the father of many nations. Well, that sure didn't look, from Abraham's perspective, like he was ever going to get to that promised end where he was going to be the father of many nations because he didn't have any children. And they were old, he and his wife. How do you get there to that end? He said, as it is written, I have made you a father of many nations. In the presence of him whom he believed, Abraham believed God, even though, humanly speaking, it sure didn't look anything like he was going to be able to become the father of many nations. He believed God, and God who gives life to the dead and calls those things which do not exist as though they did. Even after Abraham had the son of promise, God asked him to take that son up to an altar and sacrifice him, kill him. Boy, that would really be a challenge to one's faith, doesn't it? That would be walking that blindfolded conga line with the voice behind you saying, okay, now do something that is totally unexpected. And you have to believe him and trust him. But he said, okay, if this is what God says, and God said that I'm going to be the father of many nations through this individual, then God's got to have this figured out some way I don't see. And he had to act in faith. But God knows the end from the beginning. And he calls those things which be not, and frankly, which you and I look at sometimes and say there can never be, he calls those things which be not as though they are. Abraham was named the father of many nations before he had a son to be the father of many nations. Because God knows the end from the beginning, and we can hang on that promise. We need to remember that. That when things seem to be not in our lives, when things are not or seem to be not what we want or what we hope or what we know will be, we need to remember that God calls those things which be not as though they are and have faith. How does all this fit into the life of Joseph? Actually, it's pretty inspiring when you think of Joseph's life story. But Joseph's life story doesn't start with Joseph. It starts actually back with his great-great-grandfather, Abraham. Genesis chapter 15. Genesis chapter 15. Let's turn back there. We'll start in verse 1. God promised Abraham a son. Genesis 15, verse 1. These things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Do not be afraid, Abram, I am your shield, your exceedingly great reward." But Abram said, "Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus?" It was a servant, not even one of his own family. Then Abram said, "Look, you have given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my house is my heir." And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "This one shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir." And he brought him outside and said, "Look now toward heaven and count the stars if you're able to number them." He said to them, "So shall your descendants be." There's the end, God said. And Abraham is looking at that and saying, "How? Okay, God, I have to believe you, but how this is going to happen just doesn't even look possible." Have you ever found yourself in that situation? God says, "Do this or do it this way," and you think, "There's no way that that's going to come about." And he believed in the Lord, and he accounted it to him for righteousness. We can believe God. And then he said to him, "I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to inherit it." And he said, "Lord God, how shall I know that I will inherit it?" And so he said to him, "Bring me a 3-year-old heifer, a 3-year-old female goat, a 3-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon." And he brought all these to him, and he cut them in two down the middle and placed each piece opposite the other. But he didn't cut the birds in two. He laid the birds on opposite sides. And when the vultures came down on the carcasses, Abram drove them away. Now, this was a covenant that God and Abram were going to enter. And by cutting those animals in half and splitting them, as they, participants in this covenant, walked between those animals that had been cut in half, they were saying, "I'm going to hold to this covenant, and if I break this covenant, may what happened to these animals happen to me." It was a way of promising fidelity to the covenant that they were entering into. A very dramatic way, I guess you can say. But, you know, God was the one who came down and in a pillar of fire, walked through there, and was promising to Abraham that he would fulfill this agreement. Now, when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, horror and a great darkness fell upon him. And then he said, God said to Abram, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. Now, that doesn't sound like the way for his inheritance to come into this land. There was going to be a detour, you might say, along the way here. God was saying that right out front. He was saying, you're going to go through, or your descendants are going to go through, a bit of an obstacle course before they actually get to the end point here. And also, the nation whom they serve, he said, verse 14, "I will judge. Afterward, they shall come out with great possessions." So he said, the end is going to come to pass. I'm giving you this land, you and your inheritance, you and your descendants. But they're going to go through this other detour first. But they're going to come out with great possessions. And so there was this promise extended. Verse 16, "In the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet completed." So it was going to take a little time, but it would indeed happen. Notice how many things in this promise were those things which be not, at least not yet. He didn't even have a son. They were currently in the land of promise already. So they were going to have to leave the land of promise. They were going to have to dwell for 400 years under another nation. They were going to end up servants. And somehow, from being servants, they were going to come out with great possessions and then come back and inherit the land. It's a lot of things that were not yet. But God says he calls those things which be not as though they were. I mean, it was a foregone conclusion. It would happen. Now let's consider Joseph's role and how all of this worked out. And let's consider, as we go through the story, Joseph's character and how he handles the things that came his way during the course of his very up and down life. Abraham's great-grandchildren came to dwell in the land of promise. Of course, Abraham had Isaac, Isaac had Jacob, and Jacob had his 12 sons, and they were all living in the land. And among them, those 12 sons, they were the children of four different women, two of Jacob's wives and two of their handmaids. You can imagine the family dynamics that would grow up out of a situation like that. There was jealousy in the family, there was strife among the children, and it wasn't the most pleasant place for Joseph. Joseph happened to be the son of the favored wife, the only son, well, other than Benjamin, of the favored, the firstborn son of the favored wife, when the other wife had many children, and they played it up. Children knew who they were sons of. And children being children, siblings being siblings, they rubbed it in. But Joseph was his dad's favorite. Joseph was given by his dad a coat that showed everybody. Joseph was his favorite. How's that going to go down with your 11 brothers? Your mostly older brothers who should have the honor in a family, in a patriarchal system like that. So Joseph was Jacob's favorite son, and it was obvious. He got his coat. He was the son of the favorite wife. You can imagine the family dynamics here. Well, it went along this way until he was 17 years old, and Joseph had a dream. Genesis chapter 37. Genesis chapter 37. And verse 1. Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Young whippersnappers telling on his big brothers. How does that go down? Well, it tells us something about Joseph, though. Joseph had a certain sense of responsibility, and his brothers who were cutting up and not being faithful in the way that they were supposed to be handling things, it went against his craw, his nature, and he ended up telling on them. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than all of his children because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and couldn't speak peaceably to him. You ever been that way with somebody that you just had this, you can't even speak to the person? Nothing comes out? That's good. Now, Joseph had a dream. And why he did this, we can only chalk it up to his immaturity and inexperience, but he told the dream to his brothers, and they hated him even more because of the dream. So he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field, and then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and indeed your sheaves stood all around, and they bowed down to my sheaf." This is not exactly deeply veiled symbolism here. Now, maybe, and this is speculation because we're not told in the scripture what Joseph was thinking, but maybe he was thinking, I have dad's favor, and it doesn't matter. I can needle them all I want, and I could just run to dad, and, you know, there's nothing they're going to do about it or can do about it, and so I'm going to poke at them with the obvious meaning of this dream. Either that, or he was just completely ignorant of how this dream was going to be received by his brothers. But whatever, he told the dream to the brothers, and they only hated him more for it. So the brothers said to him, verse 8, "Shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" And so they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. And then, he dreamed another dream. And then, he told it to his brothers again. Well, it went over so well the first time. That he figured, you know, okay, here I go. So he told the second dream as well. And he said, look, I've dreamed another dream, and at this time, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bowed down to me. Oh, man. It's not bad enough that the sheaves, you know, earthly, now the sun and the moon, the whole heavens are bowing down to him. This is a little absurd in their minds. And so he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said, Joseph, what were you thinking? I can only imagine. But his father said to him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I, you know, the sun and the moon, shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you? And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. It's like his brothers just got angrier, but his father said, I don't get this. It seems not right, but he kind of withheld judgment on it. He kept it in mind. Then his brothers went to feed their flock at Shechem. And Joseph stayed back with his dad until such time that his dad wanted to know how things were going with his flocks. So when he goes to his brothers, he reports back. Or when he goes to his brothers who are still fuming at him, they come up with this plot. At first they're going to just kill him, and then there's the intervention of the oldest brother who knew that he was going to have to answer to dad. And he says, no, let's not kill him. Let's put him over here in the cistern for a little while. And while he's in the cistern, then Judah decides to come up with the idea, well, let's not kill him, let's sell him, and then just dip his coat in blood and you know, bring the coat back, and his dad will think that he was torn by some wild beast. So that's what they ended up doing. Reuben comes back, finds out about it, and is distressed. But they go along with the plan, and so they sell him to a traveling caravan. Now, if you're Joseph, think about this for a minute. You've now had two dreams, the interpretation of which is not exactly hard to figure out, right? You're going to be the one that everybody in your family bows down to. Now, it sure doesn't look like that right now. He's the little kid brother. And now he's in a cistern and then gets sold as a slave to a passing caravan. What is this? Think about it. What would you think about it? God, what are you doing here? This isn't exactly how this was supposed to work out. Where are the sheaves bowing down? Where's the sun and the moon and the stars bowing down when you're, you know, tied up in a caravan, somebody else's possession? We aren't told what Joseph is thinking at that point in time, but I want you to stop and think, what would you be thinking? Would you be a little irritated, a little miffed at your brothers? Maybe a little bitter at how the situation has turned around? Confused? Maybe a little bit of all of those things. Was this a trial for Joseph? Boy, of course it was a trial. Was it a setback? It sure seemed like a setback, a huge setback. Or was it a stepping stone? Remember what God had told Abraham? That his descendants were going to end up in another land? How were they going to get into another land? How was that all going to work out? This was a stepping stone in God's plan, but Joseph couldn't see that right now, could he? What about us in our lives? God says you're going to be a king and a priest in the kingdom of God, with ruling with Jesus Christ. And you think, wow, that's it, you know, straight on the way. And then all of these things happen in our lives, and it doesn't look anything at all like we're going to be rulers. How do we see it? Trials? Sure, of course trials come along. Setbacks or stepping stones? Well, we don't always see the big picture the same way God does. For God, it was a stepping stone in his plan. For Joseph, it was a decided setback. So what would you be thinking? It's just curious, you know, to put yourself there and honestly say, well, not sure, but I'd probably be thinking whatever it is. You know yourself better than anyone that way. Turn over to Genesis 39 now. from the pit that Joseph was in, he goes to the pinnacle of society. Amazing story. From the pit to the pinnacle, the height of society, he ends up having all kinds of respect and honor given to him. Now, how old was he at this point in time when the traders get to Egypt? He gets sold to the household of Potiphar, who happens to be a servant of the king, of the Pharaoh, and the captain of the king's guard, his personal guard. Some of the interpretations say he was the chief executioner. So he was the one who was responsible for protecting the Pharaoh and for making sure that any danger or harm that could come to the Pharaoh, people were appropriately dealt with. He's obviously a high-ranking Egyptian official. And Joseph is sold into that family, you know. What a fortuitous thing that is. But he's still a servant in the family. But his responsible nature, just like it was there with his dad when he reported on his brothers, you know, he's got this sense of responsibility. It comes through as he's given responsibility in his master's household. He earns more and more trust, and it ends up that he's the one over all of Potiphar's goods. So much so that Potiphar trusts him implicitly with everything in his household. Potiphar doesn't even know what's going on anymore because Joseph's just taking care of it. And he's got a tremendously influential and responsible position now in a very influential and responsible family in Egypt. He's gone from the pit to the pinnacle. But he's thousands of miles away from his family, who should be bowing down to him according to this dream. So that still doesn't look like it's going to work out, but at least he's got some respect now. And how old is he? Well, we aren't told how long it took him to go through the ranks, you might say, in Potiphar's household. What was he, maybe 19, 20 years old? Maybe early 20s? The Bible doesn't tell us exactly. I think obviously he learned a lot during his time as a servant or slave. He probably learned not to shoot off his mouth so much, be a little bit more discreet. His sense of responsibility was still there, but he was being polished. That trial was working to teach him maybe a little bit of humility, maybe teaching him to trust more in God than in his relationship with his dad, because his dad wasn't there to protect him from his brothers anymore. He had to, you know, go it on his own with God, you might say. But he did. He learned some things through that trial. A little bit of wisdom perhaps came his way. But as I said, he was a responsible young man even from his youth. It seems that his dad trusted him when he sent him to see how his brothers were doing and how the flock was being cared for and so on. And his sense of responsibility served him well here, and he rose to be entirely trusted in the household that he was serving. These other qualities were added, these qualities that he probably learned through the trial were added to his sense of responsibility, which was already a powerful, good character trait in Joseph's life. Have you ever noticed how a person has some really great qualities, but sometimes they have such glaring weaknesses in other areas of their life that they can't be trusted to employ those great qualities? Somebody might be a great speaker, but his, you know, character otherwise is so bad you can't put him in front of anybody to teach anything because he's going to sink the ship somehow or other. You can't entrust somebody who might be tremendously capable and knowledgeable about some things because they're, well, let's think about, for example, somebody who has a brilliant engineer that has the ability to work on, in the government, weapons systems. But they have a weakness for alcohol, and they can't control themselves when they're drunk. And so they would become, if they were entrusted with all kinds of secret knowledge of weapons systems of the government, if it gets drunk and then cornered by a spy, all of that knowledge goes away, so you can't even use it all. So you might have tremendously wonderful character traits and abilities, but if you've got these other weaknesses, they can't be used. sometimes what God has to do is polish us and get rid of some things that are negative so that he can use the things that are positive in our lives. And that happens through trials. Maybe Joseph was a little bit of a pompous, you know, wiseacre of a kid. And if you have that attitude, even if he's responsible, it's going to get him in trouble. It's going to get his masters in trouble. And he had to learn some things, so God had him sold to a caravan as a slave. And he learned humility, and he learned tongue control, and he learned these other qualities so that his good qualities could actually be used for good. What about us? Does God have to work with us, polish us, maybe chip off some rough edges here and there so that other things that are already skills or talents or abilities that God has given us can be profitably used? I think that's the way he works with us sometimes. Let's pick up the story here. Genesis 39, verse 1. Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made him all he did to prosper in his hand. And so Joseph found favor in his sight and served him, and then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put under his authority. And so it was, from the time that he had made him overseer of his house, and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he didn't even know what he had except for the bread which he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. So he completely trusted Joseph, just completely trusted him. Didn't even worry about what he had or how things were going, because he knew Joseph had it all in order. That's remarkable. Obviously God had a hand in this. But God used whatever character traits were there with Joseph, obviously, and blessed them. But then this situation came up with Potiphar's wife. Here was a young man. He was obviously, as it says, handsome in form and appearance. He was capable. He was a leader. And Potiphar's wife fell for him. If Joseph hadn't had that sense of responsibility, he may have broken down under the wiles of this woman and sinned. Sinned against Potiphar, sinned against God. But he didn't. In spite of the temptation that was there, and again, if Potiphar just trusted him implicitly, it would have been something that you could think he could have gotten away with fairly easily. But he did the right thing. Joseph showed great wisdom. He showed great faithfulness. He showed a lot of self-control. And again, his sense of responsibility is clearly demonstrated. And despite the advances of Potiphar's wife, he flees. He does the right thing. And for doing the right thing, what happens? He gets arrested. Now, if you're Joseph and you're thinking, okay, well, you know, that dream that I had with the bowing down and everything else, I can sort of see how God might be working this out here. I'm not positive yet, but at least I'm on the right trajectory here. And if I just keep doing the right thing, keep my nose clean, then God's going to make it all happen. And then all of a sudden, he's bound in a jail. Well, God, what's this about? I did the right thing, and now I'm here? Have you ever done the right thing and gotten punished for it? You know, you can read many stories in Scripture about how the people of God have done the right things and got, supposedly, in the eyes of, you know, some, punished for it. It didn't go well, and there are those that say, but if you do the right thing, it should go well. God will bless you if you do the right thing. No, God will definitely bless you if you do the right thing, but it may not come in the time that you want. Certainly didn't hear for Joseph. But if you're thinking, if I did the right thing, God's got to bless me, then you can get pretty bitter about it. Bitter at God, bitter at the circumstances, and you can start to change. Your character can start to change if you allow that bitterness or that disillusionment or whatever it might be to start taking over, if you start to dwell on those things. Is that what Joseph did? He ended up arrested because, of course, Potiphar's wife, she ended up grabbing Joseph's coat as he fled and then started to scream exactly the opposite of what happened. She started to scream and the guards came in and she showed them the coat and said Joseph was here and he tried to do bad things to me. And she had Joseph arrested. His character was impugned when it was actually clear. And he was arrested for doing the right thing. Verse 19. So it was when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, "Your servant did to me after this manner," that his anger was aroused. And then Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined. And he had the right to do this. He was the captain of the guard. There was probably a portion of the building that Potiphar even lived in that he had oversight of that was the jail, the prison. And it's interesting, you look up the Hebrew, the words indicate a round room, so maybe a tower type of a place that was the prison. And he had him put in confinement in the prison. And there he was. So it was a tower, perhaps, but Potiphar was the captain of the guard. And if you look over, just hold your finger here in chapter 41, verse 10, it says, "When Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me," this is Joseph speaking, "put me in custody in the house of the captain of the guard," that was Potiphar, "both me and the chief baker." And I'm sorry, that wasn't Joseph speaking, that was the other one who was arrested at the time, the butler. But they were put into the prison that was in the house of the captain of the guard. So we imagine that that's where Joseph had been put at this time. But what was Joseph's attitude as he was sitting bound in this tower? Have you ever been to a castle, anybody? Ever been to a castle, to a dungeon or a tower room? Wow, really? They're, not the most pleasant places. And they didn't take a lot of time and attention to make it a comfortable, cozy place for the prisoners here. They put them in shackles. And what was the sentence? There was a crime, you get thrown into prison. It wasn't like today where you're sitting before a judge and a jury and there are time limits, imposed. If you do this crime, then you have to spend that much time in jail. If you read the story, it's evident that Joseph was just going to sit there and rot eventually. It wasn't like he was biding his time until release came or parole came along. His choices were to sit there in shackles or hope for a pardon from the Pharaoh. Pretty dismal. Whatever happened to that whole thing with the stars and the moon and the sun all bowing down to? He's in shackles in a prison hundreds of miles away from his family. Trial? Absolutely. Setback? So it would seem. How would God ever use something like this as a stepping stone to further God's plan and purpose? How would that ever happen? He couldn't see it. And if you were in his shoes, you'd simply have to take it on faith as well. How many times does the same thing happen in our life with trials or the way that circumstances develop in our lives? And what was his attitude? Did he get bitter by it? Did he throw in the towel and said, "Well, enough of this trying to serve God stuff. It doesn't work very well." Didn't seem to work very well, did it? Did he just give up? I think it's important as we read the story of Joseph that we note this about him. Joseph's basic character doesn't change no matter what circumstance he finds himself in. Doesn't matter whether he's in Potiphar's house or in Potiphar's prison. He's the same person. His character didn't change. He didn't allow his circumstances to change him that way. He would grow from the trials that he went through. I think that's apparent. He can change in the positive sense, but he didn't let those things negatively impact his character. He's still faithful. He's still responsible. He still obeys God no matter what or no matter where. He grows from his trials. He's a better person because of his circumstances, but he doesn't let his trials break him or cause his character to crumble. Tremendously positive example for us. Verse 21. The Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, even in the prison, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison, and this isn't Potiphar, this is one of Potiphar's underlings, obviously. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. And the keeper of the prison didn't look into anything that was under Joseph's authority. Same trust that Potiphar had come to have in Joseph, so did the keeper of the prison come to have in Joseph. That tells an awful lot about the basic character and trustworthiness of this man, Joseph. The keeper of the prison had a pretty cushy job because he could just entrust Joseph to do whatever needed to be done. Took care of things. And it happened because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it to prosper, it says in verse 23. Now, I don't think that being the responsible party in the prison was exactly Joseph's dream job. Right? It's not what he would have chosen, but it's what he ended up with. Would you call this maybe a dead-end position? Where do you go from being the prisoner who's responsible for all the other prisoners? Who even knows what you're doing there? Think about that for a minute. The keeper of the prison is having a pretty easy job because of Joseph. He just sits back, lets Joseph do what Joseph does. What's his incentive to lose his best prisoner? I mean, it's in the keeper of the prison's incentive to just keep the status quo as much as possible, wouldn't it? So this is about as dead-end job as you can possibly imagine anywhere. Looks like he's going to be here for the rest of his life. If you realized that it was about as dead-end a job as you would ever come to, would that maybe start to work in your head to create this disincentive to actually continue to do a good job? Would you start to think, what am I even doing this for? Never even happened for Joseph. He was who he was. His character was his character. And he didn't let his circumstances make his character crumble. He was still responsible. He was still a servant to God. He still did the right thing. Colossians chapter 3. Of course, hold your fingers here in Genesis, but let's go to Colossians chapter 3. Sometimes in life there are those that are demoted from a position and all of a sudden they stop doing the job that they were supposed to do because they were demoted. They let their circumstance or their disappointment affect their work and their character. And we shouldn't let that happen. Colossians chapter 3, verse 23. Whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not to men. Joseph applied this. In prison. Whatever he did it as unto God, because God was the one who really saw. God was the one he was really answering to. Joseph, it would seem, knew that he didn't really answer to Potiphar. He didn't really answer to Potiphar's wife. He answered to God. He didn't really answer to the keeper of the prison. He answered to God. He just, wherever he was, whatever he did, whether it was a great situation or about the most lousy situation you can imagine, he still did it with his might. He did it as if it was to God, not to man. It's a powerful example and lesson for us. Of course, we know in Ecclesiastes it says, whatsoever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 10. He applied that principle, didn't he? Now, if what your hand finds to do is sweeping up the prison, sometimes it's hard to really get into that and do it with your might. But it was Joseph's character. He did it. And God honored him for it all. Let's go back then to Genesis chapter 40 now. Here he is. He's responsible for everything in the prison. And these two guys show up. The butler of Pharaoh and the baker, chief baker of Pharaoh. Now, how long was it that Joseph was in prison? You ever think about it? How long was he in Potiphar's house? We don't know, really. But eventually he gets thrown into the prison, and we're not told how long he's sitting there in prison, how long it took him before the prisoner guard trusted him with all of this authority over the other prisoners. But he worked his way up. Can we imagine he was in prison a couple of years at least before this would happen? 3, 4, 5 years? I don't know. You can only speculate. But eventually, the butler and the baker get thrown into prison. Chapter 40, verse 8. Genesis 40, verse 8. They have dreams, and they end up telling Joseph the dreams. Verse 8, they said to him, "We each have had a dream, and there is no interpreter of it." So Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please." And the chief butler told his dream to Joseph and said to him, "Behold, in my dream, a vine was before me, and in the vine were three branches. It was as though it budded. Its blossoms shot forth, and its clusters brought forth ripe grapes. Then Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup, and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand." And Joseph said to him, "This is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. And now within 3 days, the Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your place. And you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand according to the former manner when you were his butler. But remember me when it is well with you, and please show kindness to me. Make mention of me to Pharaoh and get me out of this place. I'm in this dead-end job. I'm going nowhere. Would you please, when you are restored, please remember me?" Butler says, "Sure, absolutely. I mean, it all came to pass." And what happens? "For indeed," he says, "I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and also I have done nothing here that they should put me into the dungeon." And he hadn't done anything that was worthy of being in the prison. For how many years? How many years does it take to start getting bitter? But he didn't. He continued to just be a Christian, so to speak, and continue to serve well. And please remember me when you're restored to your position. I'd really like to get out of here. And when the chief baker saw that the interpretation was good, then he said to Joseph, "I also was in a dream. And there were three white baskets on my head, and the uppermost basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, and the birds ate them out of the basket on my head." So Joseph answered and said, "Here's the interpretation of it. The three baskets are 3 days, and within 3 days Pharaoh will lift off your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh from you." Now it came to pass on the third day, which happened to be the Pharaoh's birthday, that he had made a feast for all of his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief butler and of the chief baker among his servants, and he restored the chief butler to his butlership again, and he placed the cup in the Pharaoh's hand. And he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to them, and yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph but forgot him. Okay, you're Joseph, you have a lot of time on your hand in prison to think about what is God doing in my life. And then the butler and the baker come along, and you're the one that God uses to interpret the dream, and you know that the one dream is going to work out well, and so you're thinking, "Okay, God, this is it. My exit pass. Thank you." And no thanks, because it doesn't happen. Can he get bitter? How many opportunities has David had to get bitter? To get discouraged, to lose heart, to say, "Oh, this serving God stuff is just, it doesn't work." Over and over and over again. But he never lets that become his life. So he's stuck there, still in prison. How much longer? You know, what would you do? We can think about it, we can ponder it, we can see how, you know, we might do ourselves. Chapter 41, now Pharaoh has a dream. And as a result of Pharaoh's dream, the butler remembers, oh, wow, you know, there was this guy who told me a dream, and I think he can help here. How long did that take before the butler had this tremendous recurring memory? 2 years. Joseph sat there in prison for another 2 years. We don't know how many years he was there beforehand, but you're added up. I mean, reasonably speaking, he was probably in this prison for at least 5 years by now, I would imagine. Here he is. The butler remembers after 2 years, and he tells Pharaoh about him. So Joseph ends up interpreting the Pharaoh's dream, and let's drop down to chapter 41, verse 37. Pick up the story there. Chapter 1, verse 37. So the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all of his servants. When Joseph interprets the dream, he realizes that there were going to be, from God, 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine on the land. And so Joseph gives advice. He says, find somebody that you can really trust for 7 years and really, you know, stock up here, because there are going to be 7 years of terrible famine to come. You need to make some preparations. And so the advice was good in the eye of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all of his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find such a one as this, a man in whom is the Spirit of God? And Pharaoh said to Joseph, inasmuch as God has shown you all of this, there is no one as discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. And then Pharaoh took his signet ring off of his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, and he clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck, and he made him ride in the second chariot which he had, and they cried out before him, bow the knee. And so he set him over all of the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh also said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. I'm sure that the day before this happened, Joseph was sitting there without ever a clue what 24 hours would bring. But God is God. God calls those things which be not as though they are. God knows the end from the beginning, and God had a plan in mind that he was going to take Joseph from the prison and put him over the entire kingdom of Egypt. Now, think about it. When you're in a situation, you're in a trial, and you can't see any way out of this, and it's been going on for 5 years or whatever the length of time is, can you trust that God can make a difference? Can you? Or do we just get discouraged and lose faith? It's easy, you know, the longer a trial goes on, the longer a situation endures, to just kind of get used to it that way. But God had a plan, and God brought it to pass in a way that Joseph probably couldn't have dreamed, excuse the pun. But God is God. Now, we're told here that Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. So the time frame that we're talking about now, between when he was sold by his brothers at age 17 to coming to the pinnacle of Egyptian society, is 13 years. 13 years. And it's been an up and down ride the whole way. The whole time, do we see a change in Joseph's character? He was steady through it all. And that's something to note. It would be another 9 years before his brothers came to buy grain, because there were the 7 years of plenty, and the brothers stayed with their father in the land of Canaan. And it took a little while before his family in Canaan was so hard up that they had to go to Egypt to get food like everybody else. So Joseph now was 39 when his brothers show up on the scene in Egypt. He was 17 when he was sold by them. 22 years have gone by. Think about it. It was in the second year of the famine. Let's pick up the story in chapter 42, verse 1. When Jacob saw there was no grain in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" I love that. Why are you just staring at each other like, you know, twiddling your thumbs? What are we going to do? "Why do you look at one another?" And he said, "Indeed, I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down to that place and buy for us there, that we might live and not die." So Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob didn't send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, "Lest some calamity befall him." And the sons of Israel went to buy grain among those who journeyed, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was governor over the land, and it was he who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the earth. Well, what do you know? It only took how many years? And through how many obstacles along the way? But here it is. They bowed down their faces to Joseph. And Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. And then he said to them, "Where do you come from?" And they said, "Well, from the land of Canaan to buy food," as if Joseph didn't know. Of course he knew. And so Joseph recognized his brothers, but they didn't recognize him. And then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them and said to them, "You're spies. You've come to see the nakedness of the land. You're just trying to figure out how to get in here for yourselves. You're spies." Now, did he know differently? Of course he did. Was he just trying to be vindictive now, getting back at his brothers? Was that what we see was the heart of Joseph? I think we can imagine that, but I don't think that was the case. This was not a matter of Joseph trying to get back at his brothers for their nastiness those 20 years before. Barnes' commentary has this note to say. He says, "All that we know of Joseph's character heretofore and throughout this whole affair goes to prove his object in all of his seemingly harsh treatment was to get at their hearts, to test their affection toward Benjamin, and to bring them to repent of their unkindness." This was Joseph's way of, you know, how would it be if he had just revealed himself right away? I mean, there were probably implications of having done that within the immediate context of Joseph's reputation, character, responsibilities, and things in Egypt. And how would he know if his brothers were any different? I mean, this is just wisdom, really, on Joseph's part, to not quickly reveal himself. But he was desirous, we see, of really becoming one with his brothers and his family again, if it could be that way. Verse 10. They said to him, "No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We are all one man's sons. We're honest men. Your servants are not spies. We're honest men. We told our dad the truth about you dying out there in the world. We're really honest guys here." Okay, well, let's see. Was their character the same or had it changed? But he said to them, "No, but you have come to see the nakedness of the land." And they said, "Your servants are 12 brothers and the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And in fact, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no more." Oh, but you were honest men. Well, he's no more. What did they mean by that? The story they told their dad was he died. He's no more. So they were being at best half-truthful here, weren't they? But by and large, honest. Then Joseph said to them, "It's as I spoke to you, saying, 'You're spies. In this manner you shall be tested. by the life of Pharaoh, you shall not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Are you really telling me the truth? I'll know you're telling me the truth if you can produce this brother you say that you have. Well, that wasn't exactly what they expected, how they expected this to go. Verse 16, send one of you and let him bring your brother, and you shall be kept in prison that your words may be tested to see whether there is any truth in you, or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. And so he put them all together in prison for 3 days. And then Joseph said to them on the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined to your prison house, but you go and carry grain for the famine of your houses. And bring your youngest brother to me so your words will be verified, and you shall not die. And they did so. And then they said to one another, we are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we wouldn't hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. They had guilty consciences 22 years later here about what they had done. They had seen Joseph pleading when they put him in that cistern and when they sold him to the Midianites, and they just turned a hard, cold heart to it. Reuben answered them, saying, didn't I speak to you, saying, do not sin against the boy, and you would not listen? Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us. And they did not know that Joseph understood them. They were talking in their language. Joseph was always speaking to them as if he was an Egyptian through an interpreter. So they were free in their conversation, and Joseph is just listening, and they're oblivious to it. So Joseph listened to the whole thing and understood them, for he spoke to them through an interpreter. I love Reuben's response. I told you so. Right? Well, he was complicit too, and he couldn't quite get out of it, but here they were. They were stuck. They had nothing to do. And then Joseph turned himself away from them, and he wept. And then he returned to them again and talked with them. And he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. And this is a big show. But I think this verse tells us a lot about Joseph's heart and character. He wasn't just being vindictive. He wept. This was not the same heart that his brothers had toward him when they sold him to that passing caravan in the first place. Each of Joseph's brothers now have a chance to show their character. Through the ups and downs of Joseph's life, we got to see what Joseph's character was. Now, through the ups and downs of their lives, each of Joseph's brothers have an opportunity to show their character. How do you really know a person's character unless that character is tested, unless there are trials? Genesis chapter 45. All of us are tested through trials, every one of us. Genesis chapter 45. Let's jump ahead in the story here. In verse 1, of course, they go back. Joseph plants their money back in their grain sacks so that they're on their way, and all of a sudden they realize that they've got all the money that they supposedly had paid for the grain. They get into this panic. What are we going to do? They're really going to think we're spies. Now we're thieves. They end up going back. They tell their dad the story, and they're in a quandary. But the famine is so bad that they have to go back for more food later on. And Jacob says, bring double the amount. What you paid for the first time, bring it back, and bring money for the next one, so that at least you go there and you're going to try and convince them that you're not just thieves and spies. But they were in a bind, weren't they? Any way you look at it, it was bad for them. Chapter 45, verse 1. They come back and they appear before Joseph again, and they go through the whole ordeal. And Joseph, it says, couldn't constrain himself before all those who stood by him. And he cried out, make everyone go out from me. I mean, he just couldn't keep it in any longer. He couldn't play the farce anymore. And so no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. And then Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Does my father still live? But his brothers couldn't answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. Can you only imagine being one of Joseph's brothers right now? Can you? If Joseph had a vindictive bone in his body, they were lost. They were totally at his mercy, weren't they? Did Joseph hold this against him? Had he taken these 20 plus years to just let bitterness against his brothers seethe in his heart? Did he let that root of bitterness spring up? They didn't know. Joseph just revealed himself, and they were, I imagine, quaking in their shoes. At what do we do now? And Joseph said to his brothers, please come near to me. Okay. And so they came near, and then he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. Remember? But now, do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. How could Joseph not be bitter? His brothers had so much animosity toward him that they sold him, lied to their father. I mean, they thought they were done with him for good. And he ends up being sold as a slave. How do you not let that bother you? And then as a result of this cruel act of these brothers, okay, so he becomes Potiphar's servant and he rises, but then he's in prison for years. For years. How do you not hold a grudge against the people who put you there? How do we do that? Joseph was able to look back over the whole situation and say, you know what? God was using this all for good. There were stepping stones. Trials, no doubt about it. Difficulties, sure. Setbacks, nope. Because God had a plan. God had to get Joseph somehow into a position to where he could save his family's life. How was that going to happen? God worked it out and tested Joseph along the way, proved him along the way. If he hadn't gone through those situations and trials, how would each one know that he could be trusted to be given these responsibilities? It says a lot about how we should deal handling with our own trials, our own apparent setbacks. Realizing, you know, the story isn't over yet. We haven't reached the end of the obstacle course yet. And God's the one who's in charge. He's the one who can see. And we just need to listen to him, because in his due course of time, we're going to be able to look back and understand how these things worked out as stepping stones to the perfecting that God has in mind for each of us. So that we, too, will be able to be used, how? By God. For life. For life. We can't afford to allow ourselves to become bitter and dejected and disheartened through the trials and the apparent setbacks that we go through in our Christian calling, in our Christian life. We can't afford it. If we do, you know, it makes that blind man's conga line just stumble around more and more. We've got to be trusting of the God who leads and directs us, to know that he says, I have good in mind for you, and to trust him. And wherever we find ourselves, and in whatever situations we find ourselves, we stay on the course. Don't let our circumstances make our character crumble. Instead, let our circumstances be tools for growth. to build us up and to be able in God's time and in God's way to use it for life. Joseph saw God's hand in all the things that worked out. You know, and I wonder sometimes, why did that butler forget Joseph as soon as he was back in the Pharaoh's household? Why did it go 2 years before he remembered? Well, let's make a presumption here. It's speculation, but let's think about it. If the butler said, there was this guy, Pharaoh, I wonder if he can't do a kindness for him. He's really there unjustly. And so the Pharaoh says, okay, let him out. Where would Joseph have gone? Would he have said, I'm out of here, I'm sprung, I can go back to see mom and dad? And then he's not even in Egypt anymore. So how is he then going to rise to a place where the Pharaoh is going to use him? I mean, if what Joseph wanted at that point in time, if that's what he got, he wouldn't have been there to provide life for the others. So God made sure that Joseph was where Pharaoh could find him 2 years later, where he needed to be. Maybe Joseph looked back on all of this and realized God had a plan. You know, even when we realize that God has a plan and that we just need to trust God to work it all out, we can still get bitter sometimes because we can look back and say, well, if I were God, I'd have done it differently. I wouldn't have done it this way. That was hard. Why did God do it this way? You know, people can still get bitter over the way God does things, but Joseph didn't. Because he didn't get bitter, the family was restored and blessed. They ended up getting the best of the land of Egypt, given Goshen, a nice fertile delta area, where a place where they could prosper. And they were away from the influence of the Egyptians out there in Goshen. I mean, what a blessing. It really worked out for their good. Joseph certainly had his ups and downs. He went through a lot of confusing times, just like all of us do. But his character never changed. He stayed faithful. He stayed true in every situation. God saw that. God delivered him. God blessed him. And so God will do for us. Let's stay the course. God knows the end of all things, and we know that God's desire is for our good. Let's trust God always and serve him. And whatever circumstances we find ourselves in, let's live as unto the Lord and not unto men.